Blog Talk Radio.
Relationships don't work between black people. Racism, white supremacy is the reason.
God bless you tonight. This is the trillion dollar flow tonight. And I'm going to talk, we'll be talking about economic, money, development. We're talking about people that are starving. Children have nothing to eat. The richest country in the world is America. I'm going to come to you tonight as the trillion-dollar flow night. Before we go any further, I want to deal with the trillion-dollar flow because that means that men fought in Vietnam and Korea. We just had Veteran Day. We just inaugurated those that died in Vietnam and Korea. Now we see the war in Ukraine, and we're seeing children being murdered. And we see other governments standing by. We see our government is taking people in from other countries. They haven't taken nobody in from Somalia. It's no people from Somalia came. It's no people came from Haiti. It's other people they're bringing in. What I'm saying tonight, the trillion-dollar flow is that you and me and you get together to make some things work. I want to thank happy birthday to you, Jerry. Thank you, Mary Hawkins. Pearl, if you're on the line, Chris Wan. I want to share with you tonight a breakthrough. I got the John Henry Clark on tonight, and he's after Africa. And he said, well, bitch, why you going back to Africa? You have to go back to where you come from. You got to go back to your home land. See, if you Germany, you got a home land. If you Russian, you got a home land. So what I'm saying to you, you have to know your homeland. You have to know what's happening. I'm praying for you, you, and you, every letter, every telephone call. I want you to read tonight, this is Friday night, Psalms 119, east, west, north, and south. I want to pray for your healing. I want to pray for your prosperity. The lady called me this evening before the show, that she got a spot on her breast. Your man called me and said he had a problem with his prostate. I told him I would pray for him. Another man called about his kidneys. I want to tell you, God is able to heal body, mind, soul, and spirit. But you got to let go and let God. He's ready to change your diet or change what's going on for you. I'm praying for you, Mother Rose. I'm praying for you, Mother Francis, back in Algiers. I want every letter, every telephone call, especially my love, Lisa. Brother Joel, help y'all. I'm praying for you, Sister Terry. God bless you. Every letter, Ramona. I keep putting you in my spirit. Call me, Ramona. I want to tell you tonight, God got a blessing with your name on it. God got a door with your name on it. And you might need to call. And the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. You know, I talked to you there earlier. You had to go shopping and everything. It's good to understand that God still that give you knowledge and wisdom to overcome all this evil. Now, I was telling Jerry, happy birthday to you, Jerry. He went to my old lady, but happy birthday to you and your wife and his wife, son, and his daughter-in-law carrying him out to dinner. That's a blessing. And happy birthday to all of you got birthdays in this month. That's when Saul and Earth Heaven came out here. I just want you to get ready for God to take you to the next level. Before this end of this, I'm going to pray. 11 to 12. We come on, I think, from 11, I mean from 10 to 11. Yeah, from 10 to 11 beyond. Mary's a bitch, that's kind of a long time. Sometimes Mary gets hanging now because something for you might be right there and you even missed it. And God already done told you it's going to work for you right then and there. Y'all hear what I'm saying? So sometimes you got to let God have his way. You got to let God move quick, fast. And somebody ought to set Bishop in a hurry. You got to wait on God to do what he needs to do. He's going to do it quick, fast, and hurry. I decree a financial blessing, east, west, north. Bright Star, I'm praying for you. And Bright Star, I just see a door open up for you tonight as your healing spirit comes. And the anointing of the Holy Ghost come. God going to do something great for each and every one of you. So get ready for a miracle breakthrough this month, not next month, this month. Starting now, God going to begin to work on your situation.
Relationships don't work between black people. Racism, white supremacy is the reason.
Absolutely.
Can't get a job in the hood and you educated. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
Can't get an education in the hood because it's expensive. Racism, white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Poor education in the hood you live in. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
You live next to poor people who will rob your ass, steal and kill your ass because they don't have no options and they don't have no option to critically think. Racism, white supremacy.
Yeah.
And I see that that's a problem. So I wanted to just make a pimp decision.
$1 trillion flow.
$1 trillion
from L.A. to Miami. brilliant people of color, people of development. You ask not, you have not. We ask it for what's ours. We are calling for you, you and you, to come into the $1 billion float. New car, new home. New land, new expression. A new philosophy. A new love. $1 billion float. $1 trillion float. We are able to have more money than the government, because we are the government. $1 trillion float coming from Egypt. Coming from the mother country, Africa, to New York and Chicago, the birthplace of Malcolm X, the birthplace of Martin Luther King, Dusab. I'm talking about $1 trillion float, the slave train. I'm talking about all laws done by Robinson, the slave train, the $1 billion float. You and me, me and you. Poor and rich. We are rich because we're in the $1 billion float. Yes, you can have that new Benz. Yes, you can have that Beamer. Yes, you can have that Rose. Yes, you can have that Cadillac. Yes, you can have that up on the hill up in New York, up in California, out in Oakland, Compton, L.A. You can have the $1 billion. Yo. You 100% real. You 100% woman. You 100% man. You 100% up with your head. I'm talking about the $1 billion float. We are right for getting what belongs to us. Give me what you owe me, and you owe me $1 billion float. I want what's mine. I want to have the best of life. I want the sun to shine on me. I want my fellas to wake up. All over the world is in the $1 billion flow. Maybe you in Atlanta, Georgia. Maybe you in down in California. Maybe you in Texas. Maybe you in New York. Maybe you in Florida. Maybe you in Canada between the $1 billion. Maybe you in St. Paul, Minnesota. Or Indianapolis, Indiana, which is about the $1 billion flow. It's going on up in New York, in Chicago, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, New Orleans. It's going on, the $1 billion flow. Down in Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Phoenix, Las Vegas, New York. We're calling for the $1 billion flow. I see you rise up and be brilliant. Say I'm rich, because I'm in this $1 billion flow. I am the richest of man. I am the richest of woman. I must have my respect. I must have my education. I must have $1 billion. I must be rich. I must lift my brothers and sisters out of the ghetto and out of poverty. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Get what I want. Have what I want. I can get it now. Right. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Look at somebody. I'm in the $1 billion flow on my job. I'm in the $1 billion flow in my business. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Why don't you get in the flow of the billionaire? The trillionaire.
I want to say to you, those that come on this Friday, we're praying to those that need healing. We're praying for those that need a financial breakthrough. And I want to tell you what 14th chapter of St. John, it said, let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, be also me and my father, our house. It was not what I told you. God got a prayer place for prayer people. I want to tell you, I'm praying for every letter, every telephone call. Those that seem like they want to see to his ministry, go to the website, go to the Destiny Land website, and you see quick, fast, and early. I want you to get ready for God to bless you this month, going into next month. It's a rough month, but God is able. I need your prayers. I need you to pray. I need to pray for people. There's so much of death and destruction going on, and we need prayer. And I want you to begin this month, a month of continual prayer, because so much is going on, and we got to have continual prayer this month or so much is going on, to continue prayer. And I need you to make up your mind, so Bishop, we're going to do a continued prayer. I'm going to bring Dr. John Henry Clark on African and America and the economics and where we should be at. And I hope we didn't come and I hope we got to go. But before I bring John Henry Clark, I want you to get ready tonight with this month. Claim your healing. Somebody said they've been having a problem with their eyes. I'm praying for the healing for that. Somebody said their legs been swelling, their knees. I'm praying for the healing for that. I'm praying that God do something special for many of you. You have not because you ask not. What have you asked God for lately? What you ask God to do for you. If you ask God to heal you, he will heal you. If you ask God to deliver you, he will deliver you. But you have not because you ask not. My thing is, what have you asked God to do for you? What have you asked God to do for somebody else that you know that needs some help? They might need mental help, physical help. And if I was looking at a drug, it's called CHT. And you take those drugs from reefers. You know, them drugs take your breath and kill so many people. And anybody been talking about it, talk about that, about the killing of so many other people that is legal. You know, alcohol is legal. You got so many alcoholics now, young alcoholics. Then you got people eating this candy, and they eat a lot of drugs, and it's messing their minds up. We got more suicide than we ever had this year, and the year having over with. More violence, you know, black on black, men and women fighting, because we forgot the word. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him, which shall not perish, have everlasting life. And God gave us something special. And that special word was a divine law. I'm praying for your healing tonight and your breakthrough. And if you just get your pencil and paper, write a few notes down, I guarantee you, you're going to get something out of this. I'll come back later on and pray with you.
We get here that he's all right, but he is not, in fact, here at the moment. And I'm going to extend to him because we've had continuing conversations about this effort and the ideas around this effort and the relationship between the community education effort and the formal education energies that are going on. We've been discussing this since Kemet this summer and when I first approached him with the idea. And Dr. Jeffries has been fully cooperative in this energy. I think he recognizes the value and the relationship of his position as an academician and the relationship of these kinds of lectures in the community. And so I know that Dr. Jeffries is truly in agreement with our energies and our efforts here, and I was hoping that he would be here to speak on that, but if he should arrive at some point, we would hope to have him do that for himself. At this time, I want to talk about the individual who has served as our guide on this 10-week historical and analysis of our time here in America and in the Caribbean. Each week when I take Dr. Clark home, we discuss one thing or another. Usually he talks, I listen. And in the course of our conversation, I actually ran across a book this dear elder has not read. And when I mentioned it to him, and he mentioned that someone else had mentioned the same book to him, and he hadn't mentioned it, and I brought the book up. So naturally, I rolled my shoulders a little bit, but now we're on ground and he doesn't know, right? So I was taking full advantage of the fact that I had, in fact, found a volume critical to us as a people, or one that I am most assuredly impressed with, that this dear brother has not, in fact, read. And so by way of recognizing that by his having this volume, this man may, in fact, have read every volume there is everywhere, it is with great pleasure that I present to our dear brother, Dr. Clark, the volume Dry Long Salt. I know many of you know it, by John Henry Waltman. And I am assuming that with this volume, and I'm sure I'm not far from wrong, that this will mean that this dear brother has read it all. And so I'll take this opportunity, one, to introduce and have Dr. Clark begin his lecture for this evening, but also by way of showing our appreciation for his efforts, for his willingness to come and be a part of our energies here, and just for the fact that this profound brother has walked among us and shared with us his very presence. Please welcome Dr. John Henry Clark.
Delivering a lecture from an extensive paper that has kind of broke my back this last month. Pan-Africanism, a history of an idea in the African world. Because I'm a stickler for what is new and what is different. And I wouldn't walk across the street just to do the ordinary. So if I can't write something exceptional about a theme, many times I leave the theme to amateurs and to students. But I looked at this word Pan-Africanism because this is the only thing that's going to save us anyway, a world unity of African people. And I looked at some new information I have on the Black Untouchables of India, numbering more than 100 million, and how they became untouchable. And the introduction of the concept of untouchability and the large number of African people in the millions in the Pacific. And I looked again at my research file on the destruction of the African people in an island of Tasmania where every single man, woman, and child was put to death. I wondered again about the international position of African people. But in my approach to Pan-Africanism for Senegal, I did not start my approach to the subject with 1900 when H. Sylvester Williams of Trinidad called the first conference in London. I started it 500 years before. When slaves on a ship, knowing what we seem to have forgotten, that though they came from different parts of Africa, different so-called tribes, spoke different languages, they all had the same problem and the same oppressor. This very evening, at a meeting at the Caribbean Cultural Center, and we were discussing African culture, how to reclaim it. An Afro-American girl said she's just beginning to understand her culture, and she resents the fact that people just talk about slavery instead of culture. And a Nigerian student, lady, said that she has no culture problem. I'm from Nigeria, and I'm acquainted with my culture, and I've had no cultural disruption, which proves she's brainwashed by the West. A large number of the slaves who came to the West were Yorubas from Nigeria. Most of the revolt was set in motion by Yorubas, led by Akans from Ghana. Now let me illustrate this for a moment, then I'm going to go into the lecture. Toussaint L'Ouverture was a Akan, but he didn't set the Haitian Revolution in motion. The person that set it in motion was a Yoruba, a bookman, a priest. The revolt in Guyana, led by Kofi, well led by Kofi, but the man that set it in motion was Ankara, a Yoruba. The Yorubas and their Akans develop a partnership away from Africa that they never had in Africa. The same thing is true of the revolt in Brazil. It is the Yoruba culture that held it together. And they couldn't get to them until they broke through that strong Yoruba culture. The main staying power of the revolt in the Western world was Yoruba. When we look at Nat Turner, this must be the Gabriel Prosser. We find the same kind of process. Then the young lady says that she understands Thomas Sowell. Because he said other ethnic groups built stores, factories, pull themselves up. And she don't reason why blacks shouldn't do the same thing. A few years ago in a meeting in Washington, it was really a meeting of anti-Zionist Jews, and I happened to be one of the speakers. And afterwards, some foreigner, the German, came over to me. You know, Professor Clark, other groups in America have pulled themselves up by their bootstrings. Why haven't your people done the same thing? I lost my cool, and I said it because someone stole our fruits, you racist. People are expecting the impossible of us. Pull yourself up by your bootstrings, and you've got no boots. The neatest trick of the week if you manage to bring it off. Then this person, she said that, why don't blacks progress like other groups? But look, every group came here looking for something. We were not brought here to be given democracy, citizenship. An American dream was dreamed, it wasn't dreamed for us. An American promise was made, it wasn't made to us. At the turn of the century, our family was less than 50 years old because during slavery, it was against the law to have a family. Now, you expect our family to be the same as other people's family? We just put it together the day before yesterday. Now, the same man who's judging you and writing textbooks about you is a man that broke up your family in the first place and made it a law against the law for someone to teach you to read. That's the same man that called you dumb. And too many times we accept the blame for a lot of things. A lack of stimulation. A lack of black hero worship.
Imperial strength. Where
you gonna see a black hero? You look at all the television you look at. Where are you gonna see a black hero? Remember when Bill Cosby played in I Spy? He couldn't even get a black woman. And when he got one, he lost. This other guy was knocking over blondes and brunettes all over the place. Oh, no, they said black men are criminals that be held feelings the other way, but the mass media has given them feelings the other way. Because the mass media in 20 minutes can do more educating than other people can do in 20 hours. Well, our kids looking at all these misconceptions of the hero, never seeing themselves emerge as the hero. He has some misconceptions about himself and his ability to be a hero. In this evening's discussion, talking about culture, and how to infuse our culture into the curricula. Everybody forgot to emphasize that slavery was a war on our culture. It was a war on the culture of all the non-European people of the whole world. And that the most cultured people in the world were told they had no culture and also had no God that was worth worshiping. So the Europeans not only gave you a new psyche, a new mentality, new clothes to wear, a new God to worship, then he didn't have to build jails. His building jails was redundant because he already had UN1 and still have UN1. When I look at this beautiful Nigerian girl writing all this conservative nonsense, but she knows her history already, and I just asked her a simple question. How did Nigeria get its name? You don't always say Nigeria. How did it get its name? All right, very simple. Near the end of the 19th century, Lord Dunbar was governing all that territory for England. And the chartered companies, these commercial companies, had their own army governing each territory, all of them rapists, all of them gangsters. Same as the two gangsters in Washington now arguing over territory. You know you got a friend among them. Just like gangsters, you take the east side, I take the west side, don't you bother my territory, I won't bother yours. They ain't talking about socialism, one's a socialist. They ain't talking about capitalism, one's a capitalist. They ain't talking about Christianity, one's a Christian. They ain't talking about democracy, and another's a believer in that. They're talking about territory, how to control it, and the fact that the white people of the world have dwindled to one-fifth of the world population. And if they don't watch themselves in bed or out of bed, we will discover they are the minority. But once they put it together, they're going to have to ask them for permission. And when we remember the one thing about power is the ability to include and exclude. There's a whole lot of people they're going to have to deal with. All right, now back to the subject. Because we have a lot of miseducated African people around the world. So we got a lot of African people who can be educated overnight. They're so hungry for it. When they had the difficulty in Fiji, when they discovered that some American blacks were interested in that case, some Africans were interested in that case, they said, we thought we were alone in the world. We didn't know we had so many relatives. They had no problem becoming African people. They had no problem relating to the other relatives in the world. Glad to do it. We're a big family. Now, my talk for tonight, and unfortunately, the last in the series will deal almost solely with the African Americans, the lonely nation away from home. Because the African American is the most misunderstood, most abused, most wounded of all the African people who live outside of Africa. And yet, he is the target for destruction by more forces than any other African people. He's the one African that the Western world won't destroy. Principally because he has grown in density to his oppressor. And he, more than any other African, have fought in larger numbers for his oppressor and mastered his oppressor's modern war technique. He's also the most dangerous African on the face of the earth, because he is the only African on the face of the earth trained in the modern warfare technique called combined operation. Combined operation is the art of striking a target land, air, and sea. No other Africans on the face of the earth have enough training to move on a target with ships, airplanes, and infantry. And the Black American has been trained to do all three. He wasn't trained to do this to liberate himself or to liberate anyone. He was trained to do this for someone else, but the training is still with him. But he has never converted his training into a liberation army for himself. After World War II, Africa could have picked up almost for nothing one of the finest black air forces on the face of the earth. But because Africa was not ready to do this, their talent deteriorated. Many of the men went busting dishes and clerking and lost all their skills. But I'm saying that the skill and the training to make a modern army was with the Black American. And right now, right this very minute, there's been enough Black Americans discharged from the U.S. Army with enough modern skills, they can train a modern army for every nation in Africa. This is what makes him the target for the colonialists, because they realize if contact is ever made with him, and if he becomes aware of his skills and affects the wedding between his skills and Africa, he could change the world around. He could have stopped the Congo situation. He can revitalize any nation in Africa. Because of his training, he can learn faster than almost any other African on the face of the earth. The question is, why then do we have slums? If he can fix houses, why don't he fix them? Why then do we have dope? Why is his institution deteriorating? Why is he debating his integration instead of maintaining his institution? Because his mind has been trained into dependence. I'm saying that one thing about Jim Crow, one thing about that oppression, it was real. You had something being built for him, by him, to sustain his institution and sustain himself. And he had no illusion about the fact that he could depend on someone else to do it for him. There was a time you either went to a black college or you didn't go to no college at all. You went to a black church and you didn't go to no church at all because you were not then and still are not welcome in the white church. And blacks created not only a new church institution, but a new religion and a new approach to God. And preached as though the God that they were addressing their message to was totally different from the God the white folks were talking about and talking to. They may well be true. Jimmy Swagger's God can't possibly be mine. This was a survival of African culture. All right. Let's see how the mystery was set in motion and what makes the difference. The difference is not got anything to do with who's got the best brain. The difference has got nothing to do with personal bravery. The difference has got to do with the isolation and the nature of oppression and what each one had to react to. And the difference has got to do with what oppressor left you with illusion and what oppressors did. Now, a few weeks ago, only 3 weeks ago, in the meeting on Marcus Garvey in Jamaica, I said, because I didn't want to disturb a lot of people by saying it in the public lecture, but in the private gathering, I said, now that the public is not here and we're just here having ourselves some nice Jamaican food and drink together, let's level with each other. Marcus Garvey is 47 years dead. If Marcus Garvey were alive today walking in the streets of Jamaica, somebody might stone him, advocating the same thing. And yet what Marcus Garvey advocated is the most important thing that is needed not only in Jamaica, but in the whole of the African world. Now, he rarely ever used the word Pan-Africa. And yet he was the ultimate Pan-Africanist, fighting for the unity of the whole of the African world. And as though it was planned, while I was in Jamaica, the very next day, they gave medals to the Jamaicans who participated in the invasion of Grenada. A contradiction to end all contradictions. Blamed that he did not succeed in Jamaica, principally because the Jamaicans then and now have the illusion of nation. And we in the United States, then and now, was never given the illusion of nation. They will let us know right now that they don't want us here. And they didn't let us dream that we were part of this nation. They let us know that we were brought to do a set labor. And once the labor was over, we were a surplus population. A nation within a nation without a nationality. We were not brought to this country to be given a nationality. We were not brought to this country to be given a status. When they said liberty and justice for all, we were not a part of the all. No one let us dream or think that we were part of the all. When we look at the atrocities against us day by day, they keep saying again and again, not you. When I say American citizen,
cats really know how to do less. Be more like your cat. Try Outstretch by Fresh Step. With stronger claws that rumble less, it lasts 50% longer, so you can change it less often. Outstretch.
Listen, I don't mean you. Now, we have, this nation has mortgaged its soul and lived a lie and tells a lie to the world because they dare not face up to the fact that you've got a massive nation inside of the United States living in under a condition many times worse than not this. The United States can address itself to Russian jewelry, always about human rights. Don't you think this girl, these cops, raped has human rights? They won't address themselves to any issue of this kind. Well, all right. Because we have not examined the illusion that went into the original entry in the United States that wouldn't go away. We can't deal with the present because we think maybe this country has betrayed us. This country has not betrayed us, didn't promise you anything in the first place because it wasn't talking to you. If you're in an English country, they give you the illusion that they're talking to you. Read the Mansfield decision on slavery. He who touches British soil, breathes British air, becomes a free man. That sounds real good. British kept slavery 100 years after that, Mansfield decision. You think the British becoming liberal? Nothing. They were freeing the slaves in England. Because the slave was redundant in England. One didn't need it in England. And either he had to free the slaves or put in England or put down a revolt of the British working class who wanted their job. So he didn't free them out of benevolence. He freed them out of necessity. Well, now when we arrive in the country, the country has not worked out its racial pattern. 1619, 1 year before the Mayflower. And we won't talk about the Mayflower people because they're not exactly my favorite people anyway. And I often tell my students if someone say they came over on the Mayflower, descended from those people, do not laugh directly in their face. Cup your head, laugh to one side. Have a good laugh. Those were discards, degenerates, thrown out of Harlem, fornicating with the sisters and the mothers in the street. Then they came to America and began to oppress the Indians. Then the governor of the Massachusetts colony wrote back to England, "Now, why did you send these people over here?" But when we arrived, they had not worked out the pattern. They hadn't even worked out the color scheme. And there were so many poor whites were indentured servants. We became indentured servants, not chattel slaves at first. And so the white indentured servant and the black indentured servant didn't see any difference in their status, so they got along well and married each other. There was no eyebrows raised about it. Poor was poor. They were all treated terribly in the filthy ships that brought the British indentured servants over was known was about as filthy as the one that brought the Africans over. So now you had to create a color scheme to put the poor whites against the blacks. While when England had put the poor whites, posed the poor whites against the blacks from the beginning by giving the whites dark categories that always made them look above and better than the blacks. And most of these whites were poor Irish. You don't talk about the Irish, not as really some of the first of the indentured servants. These poor Irish became the most ruthless slave drivers. Simon Legree and Uncle Tom's Cabin was Irish. We don't examine our literature on the subject because people beat on our head in order to impress someone else there, someone else. To understand what I'm talking about, you have to understand once more the design of the country. White, male, Protestant, middle class and up, those who agreed with the prevailing political status quo and who own property. Everybody in this country is trying to impress that group. The Jews are trying to impress that group. The Catholics are trying to impress that group. That is the big rooster in the pecking order. And if you watch chickens in a yard, the big rooster can peck anybody. But instead of pecking him, you peck the next smallest one. And you get down to the bit, but you don't peck the first pecker, which is the rooster. This is what you call the pecking order. You pass the peck down, but you don't pass it up. So the Gentile, white male Protestant, is the rooster in the barnyard. He has his way. And if you look at a book called 60 American Families, the richest people in this country falls into that category right now. And the same 60 families and their descendants who control the major wealth in the country at the turn of the century still control the major wealth in the country. All right, now, back to what happened to that original group, 1619 group. About 20. They worked their way out of indenture. They became landowners. And one Anthony Johnson became a slave owner. And why we know so much about this is because slaves could at that time take their master to court for brutal treatment, and one of his slaves had to take him to court. This is what we've got a record of. Now, I'm not proud of a black slaveholder, but as a matter of record, there was some black slaveholders. And Carter G. Woodson's book on the early black families, traditional documentation for this. Now, our history in this country is working our way around all these illusions and assuming that certain promises were made to us that were not made to us, taking handouts and crumbs from the table, while other groups and other places fare a little better, but do not assume that slavery was mild any place. Slavery was different, and being different does not mean it is less hard. I mean, the slave owner, Cruz, in his administration of the system, but he still administers the system. He still killed. He still sold families from families. All right, I've come to the American Revolution. We hear all this talk about liberty and justice for all. We believe some of it. Now, again, we have to go over a neglected but well-documented part of our history, the presence of a large number of Caribbean activists in our movement before the American Revolution and after the American Revolution. By Prince Hall of Barbados, founder of the Mason, by Peter Ogden and Jigas, founder of the Odd Fellows, by Russ Wong, one of the first to graduate from a college, one of the editors of Freedom's Journal, by Robert Campbell, another Jamaican, who would go out with Delaney and search for a place for settlement. Why this harmony between two African people who don't seem to have much harmony now? Why did they display so much good sense in the 1880s, in the 1800s, and in the 1900s, and we play, and we're talking so much nonsense to each other in the 1900s, going to the 21st century. What has happened to us? What made these visiting Caribbeans have a certain kind of nerve and inject a certain kind of sparkle in our movement? It wasn't there. They came from a system that gave them the illusion that a free man was free. These were free blacks, as against slaves. But a free black in the United States was free in quotes and limited in what he could do. The free black from the Caribbean was no freer, but he had the illusion that he was supposed to be freer, and he acted accordingly. And yet,
I added a few drops of chlorox bleach to the water to keep the flowers fresher longer.
Okay, that's a pretty smart.
They gave something to the whole movement that wasn't there. They were set in motion the colonization society. Ruslan would go to Liberia, find the Liberian house, newspaper still in still in existence. In the 1850s, they stopped coming in any appreciable numbers. And the free black in the United States began to visit them, because while there was still slavery in Jamaica, throughout the whole Caribbean island, they were free enough to invite black Americans, come down and rest up a while. All right, now let's look at the scene they had and the scene we had. In the mental depression brought on by our scene and the slight relief brought on by their scene. They were on an island. They were the majority. When you are the majority, though you are a slave, the feeling that ultimately you're going to be the master of the land, and that's true, because most of the time you are going to be the master of the land. They could go up in the hills of Jamaica, and sometimes for months and almost a year, they wouldn't see a white man. There was no place we could go where we didn't see him or reminded of his awesome power. Look what is happening to that mentality. Wilson Huggins would say years later, we rise each morning and petition for the right to live to the end of the day. And the next morning, we have to petition all over again.
He said, double F as in Freddy Fred.
Because this is where the phrase, going to meet the man. Literally going to get permission to live one more day. But if you're way up in the hills, most of the time you don't see him. So the psychological impact of his presence on your mind is not there. And you know he owns the land, you know he's a master. But physically, you're not looking him in the face every day. So this relieves the mind of being reminded constantly. While in this country, the idea was to drive us stark, raving mad. He damn near succeeded. You have to understand what happened. These two different people, all African people now, one living under one set of people, more brutal than the other, still white people, but one is more brutal than the other. One has no tag at all. The British understand slavery is a business, and they held it as a business. The American was a sloppy businessman. And sometimes he would kill his investor, his investment, unnecessary. I didn't say the British didn't kill. He killed sometimes to warn others that you better not revolt. Or you better not step out of line. But he didn't kill for frivolous reasons. He killed for control reasons. He wanted to control a thousand. That's thinking. Brutal thinking, but thinking. America didn't think that way then, don't think that way now. So we had this to contend with. After the American Revolution, now you can see why in the 1850s we would not only need spokesmen, we would begin to create an intellectual atmosphere in the New England states different we began to create a church atmosphere that was different. We had to create it that was different. Very few independent churches in the Caribbean. They're tied to some European church, Scottish church, British church. The one who need, because the missionaries, Moravians, other missionaries, let them in their churches and minister them too, but this didn't happen to us. We had no choice but to build the independent institutions because we were working with a different kind of society and relationship to the white people we had to deal with. See, more and more we're becoming isolated from the Africans and isolated from the Caribbean people. This is what I mean, the lonely African nation away from home. Still an African people, no different from any other African people when we left. The difference is the nature of oppression, and the nature of the oppressor, and our reaction to it. All right, slavery was hard in the Caribbean islands.
Yeah.
Slavery was hard here. Why didn't the blues appear in the Caribbean islands? Why didn't the spirituals appear? It had nothing to do with the lack of culture. But the blues and the spirituals are part of our self-induced psychiatry. We had to have it. We had to have relief. We developed through our church and through our reading and misreading of the Bible a romance for Jewish people. We still have. We wanted to associate with the people who escaped from something. Now you can see why we're saying, go down, Moses, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. What are you talking about? Let your people go. What is it of your people? Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. Now, who was the Pharaoh? The one your people. Now, if you read the real history of the story, it comes out differently. They were collaborators with the invaders of Africa. When the Africans came to power, the Africans said that whosoever obeys African law may stay. And those who don't want to obey African law, now that the Africans are back in power, have to go. Those were the ones who decided they wasn't going to obey African law. How did they get to be your people? Go down, Moses. Tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. Now, because we do not dig deep enough into African folklore, we don't even know where the first story is recorded about someone party received. We don't know where the Jews copied the story from. And they copied it and said it really happened. This is allegory. Allegory don't have to be true. Peter Beta Mill made a fortune out of it, died with so much money, great grandchildren won't finish spending. Charlton Heston made a lot of money on it. But he won't know one of the first African stories about parting the sea. A Pharaoh was kind of despondent And so in order to cheer him up, he wanted to go on rowing on the Nile. So all the rowers, the ladies, rowing the boat were beautiful ladies. And so the chief lady rowing the boat up ahead was rowing, then she leaned over and dropped her bracelet in the Nile. She stopped rowing. She got despondent. Ain't gonna row no more. Lost her bracelet. A necklace or something. So the magician, remember, magic had a lot to do with the creation of religions. As a two-volume work, Religion and Magic. All right. And so the magician was wrong. He told him. He dropped her necklace or bracelet. He told her, all right. So he stepped out, parted the Nile. Then it got dry, reached down, picked up a brace, gave it to her. Water came down, and she rode the boat on. Everybody was happy. That's the first story. That story was 3,000 years before the Hebrew entry. But if you look at African literature, you can find a duplication of all these stories. And I think some of our spirits will be changed around. Marilyn Anderson was singing the story in Egypt, and the Egyptian asked her to stop. I mean, the Arabs, there's no such thing as Egyptians. Egyptians don't rule Egypt. Arabs rule Egypt right now. The Arabs weren't even a people when all this was happening. So they had nothing to do with none of the greatness of Egypt. The Arabs didn't have nothing to do with it. He was the one that came in and robbed all the graves and stole all that gold. And took some of the stone and built mosques. Some of the mosques are still there. So, if you call the Arab an Egyptian, you're wrong. But we got a whole lot of misconception. Another one is in the song, Deep River, My Home is Over Jordan. How did your home get to be over Jordan? Beautiful song. You should have heard Marian Anderson in her great days. God, she could put you there. That was a singer. Pity she didn't record more. Pity Roland Hayes didn't record more either. What I'm saying is that a circumstance of history shaped each one of us a separate way. And today, sometimes when we are boasting among ourselves, all we're saying is my slave master was better than your slave master, which is the most stupid argument that people could ever have. If you get slavery, then no slave master is good. You get to a beige and would say that his slavery was mine in Barbados in comparison to Jamaica. So who in the hell cares? What difference does it make? Was still slavery. Slavery wasn't mild any place. Slavery was hard every place. All right. There was a time in Barbados when the rich planters took up all the good land, and the poor planters, slaves and all, picked up and settled along the sea island of Georgia and the cheap land along the American coast of the South. And the people that they brought with them spoke a combination of English and African. This is the origin of the Geechee. The Geechee is nothing but a beige. And I've had a Bayesian language check it out and prove it positively to be true. But it wasn't a mild situation there either. But I'm saying that first half of the 19th century, the newspaper building period, the magazine building period, the slave narrative building period, None of this happened in the Caribbean. If none of this happened in the Caribbean, it had nothing to do with one person's mentality being different from the other. One's illusions and one's condition dictated one thing, and another condition dictated another. Because we were living under the most brutal of all of it.
Life can change in an instant. Imagine being stranded in pitch black.
We would get an outlet in the spiritual and in the blue. We would sing our way out of it, try to pray our way out of it. Or we would adopt other people's folklore and fasten ourselves to it any place to soothe ourselves or to even pretend that ultimately we would be free. Now, on the eve of the Civil War, the black abolitionists, too often neglected, Douglas and others, that solidified the cause and made the issue of slavery an emotional issue on the eve of that war. Then you look at the Caribbean islands on the eve of emancipation and look at the United States on the eve of the Civil War in emancipation. You're looking at two different stories. You're looking at two different stories because two different people, both Africans, are acting, are reacting to oppression in a different way because they've got different oppressors. And must act in a different way and have no choice but to do so. African Americans would go into that war and in one battle alone win 16 Congressional Medals of Honor. It had never been done before. Why did they fight so bravely for a nation that had betrayed them and that still betrayed them? They had the illusion that if they show their manhood, maybe someone will reward them with the concept of citizenship. It was a gamble. But the gamble didn't totally pay off, didn't totally lose either. Because after the Civil War, that was 11 years of pseudo-democracy. Blacks came to power briefly in the South. Congressmen, two senators, males, more males in the South than they've got right now. Males in cities in the South that have no black males now. Yeah, that's to Texas and a whole lot of places. The position of mayor is one thing, but blacks have certain key state positions in the South during this period that they don't have now, like state position, state director of the state treasury, head of the state party, solicitor general on a state level. Now, immediately after emancipation, you want to know where did all these educated blacks come from? Some of these blacks were mulattoes, in fact most of them were, whose white father had staked them to an education, even sent some of them to medical schools in Edinburgh, Scotland. They were the leaders mainly because they could read and write. And this explains why most of the leadership that appeared in black America immediately after the Civil War was light complexion. This is not a thing like design. Now, if you look at Jamaica, it was a thing of design. The United States was a thing of convenience. I'm not passing judgment on either one. I'm merely stating a fact. Mavis Campbell, who I talked to today, a brilliant Jamaican journalist and researcher in her book, The Jamaican Color, the Socio-Political History, done the best job on color manifestation early 19th century Jamaica till the beginning of the 20th century. All right, the second half of that century, we face some problems that we haven't dealt with and finished dealing with to this day. We had been betrayed. There had been an attempt to sell us back into slavery. The promises of the Reconstruction had been betrayed. And the white friends we had in Congress, it was really only two, one in Congress and one a senator, Thaddeus Stevens and Sumner, had been blocked off. Not much we could do. Liberia had been settled. The colonization movement was underway. A little known movement we need to study again, the Negro Convention movement, was meeting every year. We are the meetingest and the talkingest people in all the world. We call more meetings, pass more resolutions, and get less done than any people in the world. We will meet and vote and forget what we voted for. We were meeting then. Our lodges, women's branch, men's branch, for the last 25 years, we begin to face reality, the shared illusion, as we never done before. Bishop Turner on the scene, a fiery Georgia Presbyterian. Back to Africa advocate. The whole concept of Back to Africa before Marcus Garvey. The Chief Sam movement, another Back to Africa movement, appeared in Oklahoma. Chief Sam was a Ghanaian. He was going to get some ships and take all of us back. The ships never appeared. A lot of people sold that material. Gathered in Galveston, Texas, waiting for the ships to come to take them away. Ships never appeared. They had to go back home, shame of face, and buy some more furniture and try to live in America. When I say that we are the loneliest nation, we are the lonely African away from home, we are the ones who fight to the United States. And when we finished laboring, the labor, the jobs became obsolete. To this day, no African nation has invited us to come home officially. The same as Israel has a law that any Jew who wants to return can return. Africa has no such law. Not one nation in all Africa. And yet Africa has more space than Israel. 1,000 times more. In fact, all black Americans fit into one corner of the Sudan and they will miss the space. Under proper cultivation, we exclude ourselves there too. Africa has been brainwashed into not inviting us home. So we came into the 20th century with illusions. We came into the 20th century with hope. We came into the 20th century changing leadership and arguing about old leadership. It was the Booker T. Washington period. It's the beginning of the Du Bois period. It was the period of the radical black journalists, especially T. Thomas Fortune and Monroe Trotter. It was an outspoken period. It was also a period of riots. Until we entered the period of the First World War, Marcus Garvey would arrive soon after. He would challenge Du Bois as the center of leadership. And he would succeed what Du Bois had failed, principally because Marcus Garvey could reach an audience that Du Bois could not reach. Du Bois, with his Oxford accent, his Harvard accent, he was always correct, but he did not reach out in such a way to entice the masses of people. What Garvey brought was some illusion taken from his growth in Jamaica. The dream of ships, the dream of nation, the dream of wholeness, and a concept that came out of his maroon background. The idea of redemption and the idea of avenging old wrong. He was listened to by millions of people, principally because he spoke a language and had a spirit that instantaneously communicated what many of the other intellects did not. We're not dealing with right or wrong. We're dealing with appeal. There have been great men of appeal in this country, but none the equal of a Garvey. Bishop Turner's preaching was mostly enjoyed in the southern area. Du Bois was mostly among the intellect and the people he called the talented ten. A lot of blacks did not read Monroe Trotter's The Boston Guardian, nor did they read The Age on another great journalist, T. Thomas Fortune, who many times wrote speeches for Booker T. Washington. Blacks entered the war and came out with more illusions. In the 20s, Marcus Garvey is getting a massive organization underway. Now there's several political strings running side by side. There's a literary organization, a movement called the Harlem Renaissance. Marcus Garvey is the political stimulant for that renaissance. He's given the lonely nation away from home a reason for being. So they invest in his ship, in his scheme. And while they regret having lost a lot, they do not cry because he gives them a meaning, a stimulus for living different from anything they ever had in their life. It is a lie to say that Marcus Garvey found black America with a wishbone and gave them a backbone. They had a backbone before. They fought before. They fought hard. But he had a way of communicating, a charismatic way of communicating that made them think of things that they had never previously considered. And that was one of his great gifts. After his difficulty going to jail and being deported back to his native Jamaica. America would soon go into the Depression. He would be forgotten until the Italian-Ethiopian War. During the Italian-Ethiopian War, he would remind us, and we would remind ourselves, we need to reconsider what he had been said about nations. Because no people can be whole without a concept of nation and nation formation. And he understood something, and this is why he was successful in building the largest mass organization ever right here in the United States. He could never have built it in Jamaica, couldn't build it in Jamaica of that day, couldn't build it in Jamaica of this day. Because the Jamaicans had the illusion that they have a nation. We had no illusion. We had no illusion by being wanted in this country. Because the Americans have let us know we were not wanted. So a drowning man, when you throw him a rope, he has no time to analyze who threw the rope. He pulls on the rope. You don't try to grab both ends of it either. All we knew that we needed some form of rescue. And we were desperate people. Now, as we moved into the period of the Depression, the Depression literally solidified our rank. But it was the Italian-Ethiopian War that made us think of nation again, made us think of wholeness, the protection of nation, made us relive some of Marcus Garvey's teaching about nation and nation structure. And it was with this and all the misgivings that we entered another war without and wondering what we would get out of it. But we had no enthusiasm for the Second World War and didn't suspect that we would get anything out of it. This is why after the war, when the Supreme Court decision about segregation, 1954, we were rather cynical. We didn't believe it because we thought that some hidden thing behind the whole thing, it really wasn't going to work. We were right. It didn't. They haven't integrated the schools. They're not going to. In all places, they're not completely integrated. They're not going to be. And we were so happy we let so many of our institutions go. But as the Freedom Rides got underway, the Civil Rights Movement got underway, the African Independence Explosion got underway. This was about nation. And here is what we needed to make a reassessment. March 7, 1957, when Nkrumah announcing the independence of Ghana said, at last the long night is over. Ghana, our beloved country, is free forever. We needed, all of us needed down and reassess our approach. We need to reassess Pan-Africanism. Pan-Africanism, a motherless child wandering away from home, had found a mother, had found a geography. Pan-Africanism now could be tied to geography. It became now a meaningful ideology for the survival of African people everywhere. We did not make the reassessment. We did not see the connection. And yet a brilliant Trinidadian saw the connection, Padmore. And he couldn't get this connection, couldn't get his idea across. He became advisor to Kwame Nkrumah. Really, he was advisor to him from about 45 on. 49, 59, he was dead. And when you look at the ideals that went into the African freedom movement and the ideals that mashed with the civil rights movement, the ideals that went into the Caribbean Federation, part of the same ideals came from the fertile mind of George Padmore, the Trinidadian aristocrat, really. Even changed his name so his other family, the rest of the family, wouldn't get confused and get put upon because of his radical activities. Came from the nurse family in Trinidad. My main point here is that we have to think now where all of us will go, but principally we have to think of what's going to happen to the loneliest African nation away from home. Numbering about 40 million people with the best technical training of any African people living outside of Africa. The target for dope, all kind of crack, all kind of crack and wise crack and everything. Jimmy Carter wanted to reduce their population. AIDS is another way of reducing their population. I'm saying that of all the African people in the world, the ones in the United States is the greatest, most tragic target. The ones in the United States presents the greatest problem to those who wish to control the mineral wealth of Africa, wish to control African people everywhere. You ain't going to have no problem with any African people who announce in the headlines that they're giving medals to those who invade Grenada and not one word of protest.
Their rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of... Chairman, friends and brothers in this first gathering of the National Conference on New Politics, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? I don't know if the Klan is in here tonight or not with all the trouble we're having with these microphones. Seldom, if ever, we're still working with it. As I was about to say, seldom, if ever, has such a diverse and truly ecumenical gathering convened under the aegis of politics in our nation. And I want to commend the leadership of the National Conference on New Politics for all of the great work that that they have done in making this significant convention possible. Indeed, by our very nature, we affirm that something new is taking place on the American political horizon. We have come here from the dusty plantations of the Deep South and the depressing ghettos of the North. We have come from the great universities and the flourishing suburbs. We have come from Appalachian poverty.
I think I like about 2C45, or you really don't want to talk to somebody or hear. It's kind of hard to see.
And from conscience-stricken wealth. But we have come. And we have come here because we shared a common concern for the moral health of our nation. We have come because our eyes have seen through the superficial glory and glitter of our society and observed the coming of judgment. Like the prophet of old, we have read the handwriting on the wall. We have seen our nation weighed in the balance of history and found wanting. We have come because we see this as a dark hour in the affairs of men. For most of us, this is a new move. We are traditionally the idealists. We are the marchers from Mississippi and Selma in Washington, who staked our lives on the American dream during the first half of this decade. Many assemble here campaigned deciduously for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Because we could not stand idly by and watch our nation contaminated by the 18th century policies of Goldwaterism. We were the hardcore activists who were willing to believe that Southerners could be reconstructed in the constitutional image. We were the dreamers of a dream, that dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man would soon be transformed into bright tomorrows of justice. Now it is hard to escape the disillusionment of betrayal. Our hopes have been blasted and our dreams have been shattered. The promise of a great society was shipwrecked off the coast of Asia on the dreadful peninsula of Vietnam. The poor black and white, are still perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. What happens to a dream deferred? It leads to bewildering frustration and corroding bitterness. I came to see this in a personal experience here in Chicago last summer. And all the speaking that I have done in the United States before varied audiences, including some hostile whites, the only time that I have ever been booed was one night in our regular weekly mass meeting by some angry young men of our movement. I went home that night with an ugly feeling. Selfishly, I thought of my sufferings and sacrifices over the last 12 years. Why would they boo one so close to them? But as I lay awake thinking, I finally came to myself. And I could not for the life of me have less in patience and understanding for those young men. For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here and now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. This situation is all the more ominous in view of the rising expectations of men the world over. Deep rumblings that we hear today, the rumbling of discontent, is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. All over the world, like a fever, freedom is spreading in the widest liberation movement in history. The great masses of people are determined to end the exploitation of our races and lands. In one majestic chorus, they are singing in the words of our freedom song, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around." And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Millions, yes, billions, are appropriated for mass murder, but the most meager pittance for foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghettos, but the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program. The modest proposals for model cities, rent supplement, and rat control, pitiful as they were to begin with, get caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-Negro than anti-rat needs to be dismissed. It seems that our legislative assemblies have adopted Nero as their patron saint and are bent on fiddling while our cities burn. Even when the people persist and in the face of great obstacles develop indigenous leadership and self-help approaches to their problems, and finally tread the forest of bureaucracy to obtain existing government funds, the corrupt political order seeks to crush even this beginning of hope. The case of CDGM in Mississippi is the most publicized example, but it is a story repeated many times across our nation. Our own experience here in Chicago is especially painful at present. After an enthusiastic approval by HEW's Department of Adult Education, SCLC began an adult literacy project to aid 1,000 young men and women who have been pushed out of overcrowded ghetto schools in obtaining basically literacy skills requisite to receiving jobs. We had an agreement with A&P Stores for 750 jobs, through SCLC's job program, Operation Breadbasket, and had recruited over 500 pupils the first week. At that point, Congressman Kuchinski and the Daily Machine intervened and demanded that Washington cut off our funds or channel them through the machine-controlled poverty program in Chicago. Now we have no problem with administrative supervision, but we do have a desire to be independent of machine control and the Democratic Party patronage network. For this desire for a politically independent approach to the needs of our brothers, our funds are being stopped as of September 15th, and a very meaningful program discontinued. Yes, the hour is dark. Evil comes forth in the guise of good. It is a time of double talk when men in high places have a high blood pressure of deceptive rhetoric and an anemia of concrete performance. We cry out against welfare handouts to the poor, but generously approve an oil depletion allowance to make the rich richer. Six Mississippi plantations receive more than $1 million a year not to plant cotton, but no provision is made to feed the tenant farmer who is put out of work by the government subsidy. The crowning achievement in hypocrisy must go to those staunch Republicans and Democrats of the Midwest and West who were given land by our government when they